You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you on November the 6th, International Stress Awareness Day. True story, and if a lot of our listeners don't laugh, it's probably because they're already crying. My name is Daniel Freeber, and I'm the host of this, the first in a series of episodes taking us almost until Christmas, in which I and a revolving cast of guests and regulars will review the men's pro cycling season that was in 2024 from a variety of different viewpoints and with observations that will be whimsical, occasionally insightful, and probably around 60% accurate. The first episode takes its name from a Latin phrase that I've shamefully overused and abused in articles over the years, annus mirabilis. It means good year, amazing year, and hence the next hour-ish will be dedicated to identifying for whom and what 2024 was a ripe and luscious vintage. Then next week, it'll be time for annus horribilis, in which, conversely, we declare who and what riders, teams, trends and concepts fairly withered on the vine in the same period. All of these review of the year episodes will follow broadly the same format in that I'll fill you in on any essential latest breaking news headlines, and then we'll go swiftly to our guests. Last week's episode dropped just a little late for me to inform you that Tadej Pogacar has signed yet another contract extension with UAE. The new deal will run until 2030, when Pogacar will turn 32, could theoretically become a 9-time Tour de France winner. An even more noteworthy number is the rumoured cost of the deal to UAE. La Gazzetta dello Sport reported earlier this week that Pog will be pocketing around €8 million a year, excluding bonuses. For football fans, that's just a tad more than James Ward-Prowse. Pog may also, though, not see out the deal. All any potential suitor has to do is fork out €200 million to trigger his release clause. You may scoff, but just a few days before this news broke, the usually reliable Colombian outlet Antena 2 reported that João Almeida and Juan Ayuso were scheming to force Pog out of UAE. Best get saving, chaps, is all we can say. Talking of fanciful transfer speculation and eye-watering amounts of cash, the Belgian former commentator Michael Weitz gave wings to a story we all thought was dead as a dodo this week by claiming in Het Laatste Nieuws that Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe had a €10 million 2-year package ready for Remco Evenepoel to join them from next year. But the Patrick Lefebvre saw them off by raising the double Olympic champs annual salary to €5 million. Good and handsomely paid work if you can get it. Of course, around a year ago, we told you that Ineos Grenadiers had a similarly lucrative offer prepared for Remco, but that they also couldn't prize him out of his existing contract with Sudal Quickstep. No news this year on a new Ineos bid, but we have found out in the last few days that their big winter staff clear out has continued, with both Egan Bernal's coach Xabi Arteche and Steve Cummings both announcing they are leaving the team. Cummings had, of course, mysteriously been placed on gardening leave, I suppose, just before the Tour de France amid rumoured disagreements with Tom Pidcock. More maybe on Cummings later in the episode. Before we get to that, I should also remind you that our latest Kilometer Zero Friends special, the Class of 04, was released this week. This very long but hopefully insightful documentary marks and explores the 20th anniversary of year one of the British Cycling Academy, which produced Geraint Thomas, Mark Cavendish, Ed Clancy and others. I think we can also hear a clip from the Class of 04 now.
The atmosphere was really good. They seemed to be progressing pretty quick. We were racing domestically mainly, but I was taking them once a month away abroad, and we would do the odd stage races like Tour Berlin, or you know, a couple of races, you know, a few of the World Cup races in Belgium. We did them sort of races. I wanted them to pin the numbers on at least 80 times a year. That was my objective. But Cav won a stage in the Girvan. You could see the progression. They were winning Kermesses in Belgium. Then that following winter I took them to Australia. We did a big block, like 3 months. And then that was then when Geraint had his major accident in Australia, ripped his spleen out. And Cav got the ride with Rob Hales in the Madison at the LA Worlds. And they won the Worlds. That was it then. That was like this moment of bloody hell, right, okay. And even Peter Keane, I remember Peter Keane taking me to one side, he said, I just can't believe what you're doing with these lads.
And just a final word to say that becoming a friend of the podcast gives you access to our Kilometre Zero episodes. There have been 15 new episodes this year. There are 300 in the back catalogue. It's an annual subscription, but there is a monthly option if you want to see what it's all about. We want to ensure all our regular coverage remains free for all. So by supporting us as a friend of the podcast, that is a big help in enabling us to keep that regular coverage free. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com to sign up. You'll receive an email with simple step-by-step instructions for how to add the feed to your favorite podcast player. It's really easy. On subscribing, you can be connected up and listening in a matter of minutes.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here at Podcast HQ to tell you that this episode is sponsored by LinkedIn Sales Navigator. Now, maybe you work in the line of business which requires you to sell and close deals, and perhaps in this tricky business environment you're finding that difficult because business-to-business selling is tougher than ever, and that's why LinkedIn Sales Navigator could come to your rescue. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professional people effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, which in turn drives higher revenue and increases sales performance. Sales Navigator can help you to target the right buyers, and because LinkedIn's platform is so huge with more than a billion members, it can give you the key information you need to target the right people, people who may be in the market for what your business is selling. And that will in turn make it more likely that you can convert interest into a sale. Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date information and it will help you unlock conversations with the people that matter. That's the decision makers in their businesses. So if you want to try LinkedIn Sales Navigator, you can do so now with a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/win. That's linkedin.com/win for your 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/win to get started.
Rob Hatch, young Richard Abraham, are you ready? Because here I come. That's a Motown reference. We should really have Larry in situ for that. But chaps, you're the pair who's probably spent most time with me on the mic this year. So I thought it was only right, it was only fair to give you the opportunity to share with me those riders, things, people, concepts, trends, who, in your opinion, have had a cracking 2024. I've given you the homework, this homework assignment. Have you got your lists?
Sort of did it on the bus rushing in very, very quickly. It's written on the back of my hand, but I've got it done, sir.
Ever the SWAT, can you hear mine rustling? All these reams of
homework. How many pages have you printed?
I can see full paragraphs of prose there written by Richard.
You didn't print that off Microsoft Encarta, did you?
Yeah.
Not 97 edition or whatever, yeah.
You were one of those kids at school, when I remember the school projects, those projects on things like the Egyptians and the Tudors. there was always some kid who had done 250, but needed multiple ring binders. And we're looked upon dimly by yours truly. Yeah.
This has started off nice, hasn't it?
yeah. It could be quite an adversarial podcast, this. Chaps, talking of our school days, I propose that I go first. Why? Because I was an opening batsman at school. I've just told you that we shouldn't have too many English references, Anglophile references in this podcast, but I was an opening batsman when it came to cricket, and I always insisted on facing the first ball. That was something that used to calm my anxiety. Always had to be on the front foot. Rob, you weren't an opening bowler. You were a sort of third change dibbly dobbler, but by all accounts,
I'd be sending you back. That's why your nerves would be down. You'd be walking back to Pavilion by now.
You would have actually caused me some problems because I like fast bowlers, hard pitches. You were a swing bowler, probably thrived on those sort of sticky dog pitches.
Daniel, you've just warned us to go easy on the English cultural references here.
I know. I'm trying to wrap this up quickly. But yeah, Rob was a swing bowler. You would have caused me problems. Yeah, I'm going to open the batting, chaps, and I'm going to submit my list to you. We'll go one by one, and you can provide a running commentary, probably, of mock and scorn. Chaps, So, who had a good year? Tadej Pogacar. No, I'm not. This is a Pog-free pod. It goes without saying that Pogacar had an extremely good year.
So hang on, I'm just going to cross really, out a few of those things I had down on the back of my hand.
We really need to reiterate that. I know that someone has got Remco Evenepoel on his list. There are going to be some obvious ones along the way. I actually am going to start with an obvious one. Matteo Jorgensen, Visma Lisa bike, who, to a certain extent, saved that team's season. They didn't win any Grand Tour stages. He was a great signing, came from Movistar in the winter, won Paris-Nice, of course. It was E3, wasn't it, Rob? Or no, Dwarsdorf.
Dwarsdorf-Vlaanderen, yep.
On that terrible day when Wout van Aert crashed out. And, well, he, I would imagine, sort of opened their minds as to his potential in the future. That maybe his potential is even broader than that team hoped and expected when he joined the team. And on the 6th of November, I also wanted to start with an American who we talked about his political leanings a few months ago, actually, and with our tongue in cheek. And I don't think that Matteo will be a particularly happy man this morning. I don't think I'm speaking out of school to say that. But yeah, fantastic year for Matteo Jorgensen. Go on, Rob.
Yeah, an absolutely superb year for Matteo Jorgensen. Pleased for him. I know we shouldn't really admit too much bias or anything, but always been really nice to deal with. A guy who seems really conscientious and happy with what he's doing. He clearly enjoys his job. He's always in the outdoors, isn't he? And like you say, really has carried that team this year and upon a landing straight away.
First on the list then, Matteo Jorgensen. Second rider on the list, a young Belgian gentleman named Eddy Merckx.
How old is
Eddy Merckx now? He's not quite 80, is he? However, I think he was on your list as well, Richard, or some version of this was on your list. There have been so many occasions this year, so many opportunities to remind everyone or educate everyone, I suppose, to some extent, younger listeners, younger readers, younger audience about Eddy Merckx and what he achieved, that I think it's honoured his career and everything he achieved. I think we have a new perspective on what he achieved. I mean, I should say the obvious reason for this is Tadej Pogacar's successes and his victories. After almost every one of these, we've sort of done a new check on Merckx's palmarès. I've talked about how I'm continually now reading my own work, which is not something I enjoy doing generally, but I did write a biography of Eddy Merckx many years ago, and it's just been really interesting to compare the different phases of Pogacar's career up to this point with the phases and how that was experienced by the world, the cycling world at the time. The awe or the surprise of the first few years, followed by the slightly more kind of disgruntled noises, a bit of hostility, and so on and so forth. And it's been a lot of that. And I think he's probably quite enjoyed that as well, Merckx. I know there was this sort of mini polemica after the Worlds, Merckx saying, oh, Pogacar has surpassed me. And then he claimed that he'd been, well, that quote had been taken out of context, which I think it probably was. But I think he's probably quite enjoyed this, chaps. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm not sure whether... I get the feeling sometimes that Eddy Merckx is a little bit tired by the comparisons. Or at least every year there's some sort of comparison. But then again, you can imagine a scenario where he's actually quite happy to still be brought up. I put on my list Eddy Merckx comparisons, not because I thought it was a particularly good year for Eddy Merckx, but I think this year's the year when Tadej Pogacar has morphed from the rider who we think or thought could have been Merckxian, cannibalistic, to the rider who has kind of entered that bracket, not only just by doing the triple of Giro Tour Worlds, which only, it was Merckx and Roach, wasn't it? The only other two riders who've done that before. But just in the dominance and the sort of Merckxian nature of the season that he's had, I think he's gone into that bracket in a slightly different way. So that was why he was on my list as the comparisons. A good year for people who written Merckx books, Merckx experts.
Well, apparently not. Apparently not. I've had my royalties statements through, and yeah, it's thin gruel on that front, I have to say. Maybe I'll get a bit of a dead cat bounce at some point. Chaps, next on the list, this is going to shock you, Ineos Grenadiers.
Yeah.
Eh?
Ineos Grenadiers. How many wins did they have? 14, was it? Did they have a win?
How many World Tour wins? Not so many.
Did they have a win after the Tour de France? Why is it a good year, particularly at the end of a period in which we've had this conversation almost weekly about what is wrong with that team? How do they fix it? Is there any future for this team? Chaps, I think that sort of the best thing that could have happened to them, obviously, besides having a brilliant season and being, you know, meriting inclusion in my Annus Mirabilis list by virtue of their victories and so forth, the best thing that could have happened to them in their rebuild, and don't forget, we started the year talking about the need for them to rebuild, reboot, reset, is a disaster. And it has been a bit of a disaster, particularly the second, the sort of coda of this year since the Tour de France has been a bit of a disaster. And I think as a result, they will have undertaken a level of soul searching which they wouldn't otherwise have undertaken. There's no opportunity to paper over any cracks. They need, what they need is open heart surgery. And I think, in my intro to the pod today, I talked about a couple of the coaches leaving, or one of the coaches and direct sportif Steve Cummings leaving. There are a lot of other staff leaving as well. I think that's what's happening. I'm not sure whether it's going to be successful. You know, I was looking, did a bit of deep dive into some statistics about their season this week. They've never been a team that has got in a lot of breakaways, but it struck me, I noticed that they're not in the top 20 teams in world cycling, all divisions, so World Tour, Pro Conti, for kilometres off the front of races in breakaways. Visma and UAE are fifth and sixth, respectively. I mean, that's not necessarily a fail-safe guide of how good a team is, but you know, it's something that maybe when they do rebuild, rethink, that they might have to revise. They've never been a team, as I said, that's got a lot of breakaways. One bright note, I would say, they have had this year the highest percentage of points scored by riders under the age of 28 of any team. So the youth has, to a certain extent, delivered for them. I know Pidcock didn't necessarily on the road have the season that they might have hoped, but they have got some good young riders. Another, you know, there were other bright notes. I thought they rode really well at the Giro d'Italia. Okay, Geraint Thomas didn't get on. Did he? No, he did get on the podium. He finished third in the end. Didn't get the result he wanted, but I thought they rode really sort of coherently at the Giro d'Italia. And Thomas is, of course, still going to be there next year. But the bottom line, my message is that they needed a disaster, and that's what they got, unfortunately.
I understand where you're coming from. Is it enough of a disaster to provoke what they probably need, which is a massive change in the management structure? And I say that because every time we speak to people off the record, they say and they intimate to us that no, things aren't well in the dressing room, things aren't well behind the scenes. I know they're changing. I know they've just announced
Is that just the sort of attrition, the friction between an old regime and a new regime?
Could well be, Daniel, could well be. But obviously, whatever has been changed before this year, in terms of the results, hasn't worked. And I know that there's some quite prickly responses that colleagues have received from the team because of, you know, basically saying things like that. But all we are doing is doing a journalistic job and stating the facts. They have not been winning anywhere near as much as you'd expect for A, the investment, B, you know, the history of the team. So is it enough of that? Is it the sort of etch-a-sketch end of the world where you completely ruin the drawing and start from zero? And I don't disagree, Daniel, in terms of maybe that is what is needed, but they're certainly at a big crossroads now, given the investment of the group in other sports and other very famous teams that are changing their management structure this week as well.
The riders were all at Old Trafford at the weekend, weren't they? And of course, Manchester United announced last week, Ineos part owns Manchester United, announced last week that they were going to appoint a new manager And there are some strong parallels, aren't there, between the current positions of the two organisations, I suppose.
It's almost uncanny, isn't it, when you read stories about Manchester United, the football club, and in a lot of cases you can substitute football for cycling and Manchester United for Ineos Grenadiers. And a lot of the way that the general sort of narrative and what's been going on. I think I can see your point, Daniel, but I think I'm not sure a team necessarily has to go through a year like this and what's happened in order to have that rebirth and sort of metamorphosis.
Pain is the best catalyst for change, Richard, in life, in sport. Change only happens when the prospect of things staying the same is more painful than the prospect of change. Chaps, we should move on. Decathlon, Ager d'Auxerre, La Mondiale. Richard, you've got them. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to leave them to you.
Well, I left them to you, Daniel. Please.
Oh, well, you know, just a fantastic, particularly first 6 months of the season up until the Tour de France. It didn't go so well at the Tour de France. But then Ben O'Connor rode that fantastic Vuelta. The only sort of note of caution, I would say, is that there is a feeling in France that they may have sort of got drunk on their own hubris, in the sense that they've let a lot of experienced riders go, like our own Motown maestro, Larry Warbass. I think they've got 7 Neopros next year,
And I'm surprised by the recruitment. I don't have the list in front of me, Daniel. It's funny, actually, I was doing research for next year on Decathlon yesterday, so fresh in my mind. I don't have the number to head up, but I was looking at it. I was really surprised by their recruitment, actually. I didn't think that they required too much of a change. I'm not saying that that isn't going to go well, because some of the riders who are turning professional are very, very, very promising riders who we've seen in under 23 worlds and junior worlds and things like that. We all know the way it's going. Plus, they're going to get a brand new sports director in the shape of Luke Rowe. Again, we never know how that's going to go, but he's obviously fresh out the peloton, has knowledge, will be enthusiastic. That's going to be one to watch. They will carry that positive nature through, but the changes in personnel did surprise me as well, Daniel.
Yes. If I had to guess, if I had to speculate, I would suggest we might see another rip-roaring start to the season. And what you hear often in teams which are maybe overpopulated with young riders is things can get a little bit ragged in the second half of the season when people start to get tired. And what you need is experienced sort of stalwarts just to kind of carry or row the ship into port. Oh, where am I going with this? Terrible metaphors. Anyway, chaps, another team I'm going to focus on next. Next on the list, two names, two riders, Pavel Sivakov and Marc Soler of UAE Team Emirates. Why? Because I think both of these riders have been absolutely key this year, and to a certain extent against the odds. They've confounded expectations, because there has been a feeling with this team that it has just sailed along on the backs of clinging on to Tadej Pogacar's cape, and that it has remained a little bit, well, in the image of Marc Soler at times, a little bit sort of mercurial, a little bit up and down. And Soler himself, he rode a brilliant Vuelta, and particularly that Lagos de Covadonga stage. He was in 1,700 kilometres of breakaways this year. Only three riders spent more time in breakaways. Can you name any of them, chaps? Any guesses? I'll give you the names.
Abrahamson? Jonas Abrahamson.
Yes, very good. He was one. Manuele Tarozzi was another. And Dries de Bont was the third one. So Soler...
Talking of the image of Soler, Daniel, you mentioned that. You set the little chat group we had to organise this recording has got an image of Marc Soler sort of... I'm assuming you took it. Did you take the picture?
I did, yeah.
He's standing sort of nonchalantly inside... what was this? Was it a Carrefour?
Yes.
Supermarket. With like there's some crash barriers, one arm resting on his knee on his back wheel, just a sort of air
pure
of
aura,
casual,
yeah.
He hasn't got a Calippo in this one, does he?
No.
Calippo made an appearance at some point. But
last week, we had the story of him bringing, him regaling the UAE staff with a lovely jamón ibérico before the Tour de France last year, and, you know, bringing them all sorts of delicacies in some kind of hamper they gifted to them. So anyway, you know, Marc Soler's reputation has certainly been enhanced. And, you know, it was only a couple of years ago when, of course, he finished outside the time limit in a stage of the Tour de France. And that seemed to be, that was the first year after he signed for the team. And at that point, it was very easy to question whether it had been a good signing, whether this was the kind of guy that Tadej Pogacar needed, whether he was really going to be a part of their thinking when it came to the really big races in the future. And he has proved his worth this year. Sivakov, there was quite a lot of skepticism about his signature. He plateaued a little bit at Ineos Grenadiers, I think by his own admission. We had a big interview with him at the end of last year. He was a guy who seemed to be crashing a lot, seemed to have become a bit fragile. And there were times, particularly in the second half of the season, where Tadej Pogacar really relied on him to a certain extent. I think Pogacar would have won all those races anyway, but Sivakov also rode a really, really good Vuelta, was a bit unlucky a few times, and was brilliant in the Italian Classics at the end of the season. And that was an example of UAE improving riders, as they've improved quite a few riders. Adam Yates is another example from the last few years, but there have been more. Rob?
I think one thing that UAE Emirates have learned to do really well in the last 18 months has been give riders their opportunities to get their own success as well as doing their day job, working for the main man, Mr. Pogacar. Don't ask me how they do it, because again, times watching, you think, why? Oh, hang on a minute, shouldn't they be saving them for another day? But I guess that's us, we're using our traditional look at tactics and things like that. And I can say that for a lot of the experts who sit alongside me in the commentary box, you know, we'll look at each other and they'll be going, you know, surely they should be waiting, resting up for tomorrow. But it works. It keeps the morale good. It keeps everybody happy. It keeps the win count ticking on. And what was the win count up to? Something stupid this year, 80-odd wins, 90-odd wins, something like that for UAE Emirates, breaking all sorts of records. And obviously, you know, very cliche, but success breeds success. And if you've got happy riders, they're going to give that little bit extra, aren't they, for the leader as well. Certainly, they've been allowed to do their own thing too. And Soler, Sivakov really going for it at the Vuelta a España. Soler really impressed me, because I think he has come completely full circle. I was one of the big Soler skeptics, I think, at the start when we saw what he did in Movistar. And a lot of that, I guess, is temperament and maturity. And Soler's, I think, become a father a couple of occasions now. Things have changed in his life. What is he, 30 now? He's sort of been around for a while. It's one of those things we blink and, you know, suddenly riders we thought were young riders in our 30, early 30s or whatever. He's one of those guys who suddenly seems to have matured, and, you know, he's proven what an exceptional bike rider he is.
Chaps, I'm going to have to rattle through some of the others, because we have discussed some of the first things on my list in greater depth than I thought we would. Jan Ulrich, 1997 Tour de France champion. This is not another plug for a book that I wrote, but
it says more book plugs than Boris Johnson.
But it has been nice just to observe his journey from afar this year. He had a lot of problems with alcoholism and other addictions that he's talked about himself, and he seems for the moment to have conquered those demons. And every picture, every video you see of him, he's wearing a big smile and seems to be thriving. That's been nice. Ketones. It's been a good year for ketones. I think generally the conversation around ketones has become a lot more grown up, and we've become accustomed now to seeing riders swigging ketones after races. And frankly, I didn't re-listen to last week's episode, but we did have a conversation which might have been cut for reasons of brevity about sort of hand-wringing in the French media in particular about ketones. And I don't really have much time for it, to be honest. I think François Thomazeau's motto maxim that doping is a legal problem, not a moral problem, is very apt here. And yes, ketones are still sort of under the microscope from the powers that be. They may yet become doping products, be added to the banned list. There's evidence that they raise EPO, for example, naturally occurring EPO, minimally, but there is some evidence to suggest that. But as long as they are not on the banned list, and as long as there isn't good evidence that they damage people's health, then, you know, I don't really think that anyone should have too much compunction about taking them, including publicly. Collectors, chaps, is the next rather obtuse item on my list. Why?
Because in capital letters on your list as well.
Why? Because five riders completed their collection of stage wins in all three Grand Tours this year, more than ever before, than in any other year before. Can you name those five?
I should be able to do, but I'm still on the holiday mode. I only got back last night. I will tell you, though, that it seems increasingly common in my prep for races now, doing my day job, that we're writing about it more. It seems to be much more sort of popular thing, riders aiming to take these three wins. And I think not long ago, we got past the 100 riders in the history of cycling, Mark. Yeah, and it's accelerated in, 18 months by, over 10 riders or something like that. So it's becoming common. And another, I now make a separate line in my prep for each Grand Tour of riders aiming for that, because riders come out and say, this is what I want to achieve.
You're playing for time quite masterfully here, yeah, but I can see you still haven't. Have you remembered any?
No. I'm not even looking for it, mate.
Richard, any names?
Is Campenaerts one?
Campenaerts is not one. No, I'm going to give them to you. Ben O'Connor. Richard Carapaz. Remco Evenepoel. Julien Alaphilippe. And Tadej Pogacar. There he is, second mention in the podcast. A similar sort of statistical quirk gets my next, or is the reason for my next entry, which is families. Why? Alexander Kristoff, Uno X, had an excellent year. He won 8 times, but he also won a race. Oh my God, I'm not even going to try and pronounce this. He won a 1.1 Belgian race on June the 1st. And his 18-year-old brother, Felix Orn Kristoff, also won that day. He won a TT in the Saarland, it's called Trofeo Saarland, but it's a German race. And Felix, how would you pronounce that in German? He is joining Intermarché in 2026. Felix Orn was born the day before Alexander started the 2006 Istrian Spring Trophy. So he was already sort of a professional at that point. In fact, Alex rode the Tour de l'Avenir in the year of Felix Orn's birth. So two brothers winning on the same day. Two cousins also won on the same day this year. Jefferson Alveiro Cepeda of Caja Rural won the GC and Tour Qinghai Lake. And the same day, Jefferson Alexander Cepeda of EF Education Easy Post won stage one in the Tour de l'Ain, which started in a place called Saint-Vulbas, which we might mention later on. Next one, comebacks. A lot of that, there was that dreadful crash in the Tour of the Basque Country, and there were a lot of very good comebacks, rousing comebacks from riders involved in that crash. Vingegaard, Jay Vine, Mikel Landa, who had a fantastic season, 8th in the Vuelta, 5th in Tour de France, 2nd in Catalunya. Remco, of course, Roglic, who went on to win the Vuelta a España. Some other good comebacks. Tom Gloag of Visma Lisa Bike. He was out of action for 362 days after being hit by a car and breaking his knee cap. He promptly returned and won a stage, I think the sort of queen stage of the Czech Tour. Other sort of longer term, more stretched out comebacks. Eddie Dunbar had a lot of problems, came back and won a fantastic, double at the Vuelta a España. Stevie Williams as well had a lot of problems at the start of his career, sort of completed his redemption arc by having a great season winning Flèche Wallonne. Chaps, a couple more. We're coming to the end now. Shimano, very good year for Shimano. It's easy to forget that. It wasn't until, I think it was 1999, when Shimano won the Tour de France, a Shimano group set won the Tour de France for the first time. This year at the Tour de France, it was the first year without a Campagnolo-equipped team. And Shimano won all but one stage. The stage they didn't win was won by Jonas Vingegaard, And of course, Visma Elisa Bike are on SRAM components. Next item I've got, eating. Chaps, there was a lot of talk about eating this year. Some of it quite
fueling,
salutary.
I think you call it nowadays,
fueling,
don't you?
Fueling, eating, food. Pog talking in that Peter Attia podcast about not worrying about his diet until very recently. The whole sort of sugar carb revolution. We talked a lot about this year, how that was really changing cycling. Increased intake of carbohydrate in races. Jonas Abrahamsson, we already mentioned, there was that quite heartening story in the Tour de France of his weight gain and the sort of message that he was trying to send out to young cyclists about not starving themselves, not becoming a slave to strength to weight, power to weight ratios, and actually sort of showing his best self when he became a lot heavier. Lay's 3D bugles, do you know what they are and why it was a good year for them?
Well, they're crisps.
Lay's,
they're
crisps. Yeah, Lay's, L-A-Y-E-S.
Can you think why it might have been a good year for them?
Bugles.
Because they got some free Gorilla advertising where the fella who chucked, emptied a bag on them of them on Tadej Pogacar at Pladadi.
And they were.
Yeah, and it took...
I thought it was chips. In, my memory says it was chips.
No,
as in like,
no, Richard. It
soggy
took me,
chip shop.
No, it took me longer than I would care to confess to identify. I went on a deep dive earlier this week, which involved lots of Google image searching. And I can fairly conclusively
you really
tell
have nothing
you,
to do, have you?
I can fairly conclusively say that they were Lay's 3D bugles. Last thing I'm going to put on the list, journalistic integrity. Now, it was a bad year for journalistic integrity in that I think the Netflix, the much, much trumpeted Netflix docuseries Unchained took too many liberties. And I heard a lot from people in the sport, in the second half of the sport, after the release of the second series, that they were pretty upset with how many journalistic liberties had been taken, sort of interviews about one subject patched together with something else, or things shown in unchronological order in such a way to promote a certain narrative. And yeah, I know quite a few teams were pretty upset about this, and it had real world consequences as well. I think Jasper Philipsen at the Tour de France, he really suffered for a week or so because there had been this narrative that had been promoted about him being a sort of villain of the sprinting world, and I think his confidence and the way he went about sprints at the Tour de France was affected by that. He sort of admitted as much. I think that Steve Cummings' Pidcock imbroglio was affected by the Netflix documentary. And, you know, I've heard stories about them sort of fairly transparently trying to, and we, you know, we do this as journalists, but trying to really sort of egg on or sex up certain narratives. For example, next year's series, I know they showed a great interest in, suddenly at the end of the season, they showed a great interest in interviewing João Almeida and Juan Ayuso at UAE, having not been that interested in those two characters before. And it was pretty obvious why. But I think the teams next year, and there will be a series next year, and it's a very entertaining series and it's good for cycling in general, but I think the teams next year will make sure that journalistic integrity is respected and honoured to a greater extent. And that's a good thing, because it annoys me as a journalist when we get a bad name because people do take these liberties.
I think my first thought when watching the second series of Unchained was that it had strayed just a little bit over that line into augmented reality. The only way is cycling. And I think it sort of gained its place and its access under the guise of being a journalistic investigation. But I think the end product has veered into slightly, but overdramatic storytelling focused.
Melodrama.
Melodrama, which this isn't new to the sport of cycling, is it? Sexed up melodrama, I think, was a key component of the 1903 edition and reporting of, you know, it's been there the whole time, hasn't it? But I do get your point, Daniel. And I think what's curious from a sort of journalistic point of view is the incredibly privileged access that Netflix do have, that is nothing else comes close to that level of behind the scenes access, and then access in the race of the Tour de France. I mean, the producers and the cameramen and women are essentially badged up, or they are literally badged up as team members, and so afforded the access that you get from that. So it will be interesting. I mean, they were there this year, weren't they? So the assumption is there will be a third series of that.
Yes. Behave yourselves, Netflix.
Otherwise, Daniel will come and get you.
Yeah. I'll cancel my subscription.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by a map.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Right, next up, Rob Hatch. I already know what might be the first item on his list. It was a good year. It's been a good couple of weeks for Mallorquin burglars. Burglars in Mallorca, because I stayed at Rob's house and he left me there. He went to... Where did you go? You went to Istanbul?
I'm in the mainland, under Asturias, then Istanbul.
And I did a bad job of... locking up, but he didn't get burgled.
No, I've had a double check this morning.
It could have been a good year.
I don't think it was entirely Mr. Freiber's fault, because of course you'll have all seen the news about the awful events in Valencia and on the mainland, and of course here in Mallorca we're not too far away. The tail end of that storm passed by, I think, after you'd left, Daniel, and a not very well shut back door turned out to be blown open, I think. Thankfully none of the glass is broken or anything like that, so we'll get on with the list. I tell you what, the first thing on my list could be used to describe several times in several different ways, and I think with all the languages that cycling's broadcasting in several different languages, what you did at my house, thesaurus sales have been skyrocketing, I think, this year in amongst my colleagues, amongst journalists, because how do we keep continuing to narrate, to comment on and talk about Tadej Pogacar's almost weekly exploits, 100-kilometre attacks? I think back at the start of the season in race number one, what did 80-odd kilometres to go? I said in commentary, I don't think we'll see this again. How wrong I was. It continued. It got bigger. It got better. How do we keep narrating these things? So, yes, there's a new thesaurus on order, and I'm sure it might be the same for people who maybe challenged. I mean, I'll do all right in other language, but English isn't my strongest, as you know, Dan. You know, you've got a pretty good vocabulary. You'll be doing all right.
Remember when it was in the Vuelta, in fact, when Fran Reyes, in his inimitable style, talked to me about asking interview subjects to draw pictures rather than answer questions verbally. And it feels as though we might have to kind of revert to a different form of kind of performance art to fully represent what Pogacar is doing on the bike. I mean, in future, we might have to dance about it.
Poetry.
Not poetry. Please, not poetry.
Well, no, I won't go there. It doesn't seem important. It's not important in the grand scheme of things. I don't want to overestimate our importance, but of course, we have a story to tell. And you know, I think if you want to do your job properly, you're bothered about how you tell that story. You don't want it to be monotonous. You don't want it to be the same every week. And of course, you know, there are times in races where when something similar happens again, you know, you're enthusiastic, but inside there's a bit of a worry thinking, oh my God, am I going to tell this sort of similar story yet again? And that's where we got to the end of the year. That is not to diminish by, in any shape or form, the story being told. It's only to make it more impressive because it's fantastic. But yeah, that's a little bit of a worry we had towards the end of this year. Another one Slovenian flag makers. How about that? Because they are everywhere. They were everywhere the last few years. They are increasingly everywhere. And I think that leads me very quickly onto my next one. Slovenian branches of Going Places, Lumpoli, and yes, for anyone who's not from 1990s UK, the travel agents. The number of Slovenian fans taking those flags all the way to those biggest races in the world and wanting to see their heroes. We see it, don't we, cyclically? We used to see the Slovakian flags everywhere for a while, didn't we? Obviously, you've got the traditional nations that you always see. We see the Eritrean fans everywhere, but yet the Slovenian fans seem to be everywhere and they're enjoying their hero.
It's still, I mean, it's a very small country, isn't it? Was it 2 point something million? So it's a very relatively, as I've said before on the podcast, relatively small cohort delegation and quite, I would say, I was going to say sober, but they're not necessarily always sober, or they haven't been on the best.
What are you alluding to?
No, but fairly understated, I would say.
Yeah.
Not as raucous as others that we've seen before, as the Danes or even, you know, the Norwegians or even the Americans going back to the days of the controversial Lance Armstrong.
Well, while we're on that, let's move on to the next point on my list. And I'm going to emphasise the second word here because of the events of overnight. US cycling, the emphasis on cycling. What a year it's been for American cycling. And if you look back to the World Championships, gents, and look at the lineup of their men's team at the World and all of those names together, and they were right up there with the very more traditional nations, weren't they? You know, at Worlds, you think, oh, look at the Slovenians nowadays, or traditionally, look at the Belgians, look at the Dutch, look at the Spanish, the Italians. That American team, it was a long list of ballers, wasn't it? And you've already mentioned Matteo Jorgensen as sort of the leader of the pack, but he's not the only one at the minute, is he?
No. Things are looking pretty bright for them. I don't know. I hesitate to say, do I dare to say that this is still a bit of a legacy of some of the success they had in the early part of this century? And I think, to be honest, I think some of these riders have been quite transparent about that, haven't they? They've talked about
it. Refreshingly honest about that, I would say, because, you know, you can expect from people who don't listen to every word and aren't capable of understanding any nuance, of which on social media there are many. I think it's a pretty sort of easy thing, an easy target, isn't it? So it's refreshing that people are quite honest and open about that.
But Rob, I think we do need to add a little another asterisk. This is the second one. This all takes place against the backdrop of a bit of a meltdown in the US domestic scene,
yeah.
And that's been happening for a few years now. And I don't really see too many signs that things are improving on that front. Certainly no immediate prospect of a big race being revived or created, a race that might welcome the top European professionals.
And the style of racing is so much different as well. You speak to American riders and they'll be the first to say, well, I had to get over to Europe. I had to be there because the roads are different. The style of racing is different. It's one thing winning races. I'm not suggesting one's better or whatever, but they're just very, very different animals, aren't they?
I think a year when we didn't actually see that much from perhaps America's brightest talents in Sepp Kuss. It was a year of illness and sort of bad luck, wasn't it, for Kuss, who didn't really push on in the way that I think a lot of people were expecting or hoping after last year's Vuelta, but certainly not the end of his story.
No, and let's not forget he won a stage race as well. You know, considering all those issues that Sepp Kuss had, he didn't, you know, by his own admission, feel like he was big, but, you know, he still won a stage race and one of the few stage races that was taken really by Visma Lisa bike at that time of the year in the Vuelta a Burgos. So not a complete disaster by any means, I thought, for Sepp Kuss. Right, let's move on. It's been a very good year for agents, hasn't it? As every year seems to be. One link to, I think, the increase in professionalisation of cycling, the way it's catching up to other sports in this regard. We were hearing, I think, what, just 24, 48 hours ago about Tadej Pogacar's new contract. Another one, what is it, 2030 now he's signed up to? 8 million euros a year is the rumour. We obviously never really know the exact figures in these sorts of things. Wout van Aert signed, still not sure how this is going to work, but for eternity with his current team as well. There's all increase in number of contract renewals. I think we seem to get more press releases and emails about that than any other thing at the minute. And it just seems like, you know, there's more agents on the scene. There's more work on the scene. There's more riders to get from youth categories and to get them on the pro contracts and things like that.
Yeah, that's definitely true, Rob, because they have broadened the talent pool. They're fishing with a much bigger net or in a much bigger pond. Also because the growth of the women's sport has been a huge area of opportunity for agents. And I hear this a lot that, well, there's exponential growth in certainly the salaries of the best women. And as I say, the agents are filling their boots to in some cases, not in all cases, because it's also a world that's become a lot more competitive over the last few years. And we've talked a lot about long contracts, haven't we? And that is another fertile, that provides another big opportunity in some cases, because if riders are to be bought out of their current deals, you're talking about things like penalty clauses, riders having to, teams having to sort of effectively do what football teams have to do to secure the services of riders, then that's another opportunity for agents to sort of insert themselves in other ways, in a sort of bilateral fashion in some cases. And that's probably not a development that the teams are particularly relishing.
Yeah, I think that it's worth stressing, actually, this by mentioning agents, as it's been a very good year for them. It's not just a negative connotation I want to bring that up with. Of course, there are negative sides, as you stress, for maybe financial health of teams and things like that. There's always a balance to strike. But in terms of striking that balance, athletes need representation. They need people to do that for them. They need them to do their bargaining. And of course, that, you know, if you're looking at the athlete side, that can only be seen as a positive thing, can't it? So the agents have had a very good year. And related to that, on my list, getting towards the bottom now, so don't worry, nearly done. Young riders. I think young riders are increasingly signing those contracts. I mean, I think it's clear that the stats tell you that, you know, riders are becoming younger. I still think that we are getting closer maybe to a change in the age or even abolishing the best young rider jerseys in the races, because younger riders are winning more races. And we're seeing more focus on the junior categories rather than the under 23s now. Riders at the age of 18 on a couple of occasions in the past two winters turning pro as World Tour riders. You know, Ineos Grenadiers, and I think this year Lidl Trek have somebody who's going to be turning pro at 18. They're increasingly better when they come to the sport. Of course, there's other conversations to be had about burnout and all sorts of things, but it has certainly been a very good 12 months if you're a young rider and you want to turn pro and you want to be thrust straight into it.
Yeah, I would add one discordant note to that, Rob. I would say it's a positive development for riders who are very good at 16, 17, 18. However, for those who mature a little bit later, and we've seen lots of riders as well come to the sport quite late, and that happens increasingly. And that's also, I mean, in fairness, teams are also looking to other sports in some instances for potential. But if a rider happens to be focused on studying or another sport or something else when they're 16, 17, 18, there is the possibility that they will miss their opportunity. Unfortunately, there are a few examples of guys in the World Tour for whom the sort of boat has come back around, like Sir Vergalito, who won Zwift Academy, and there are a few actually who have come into the sport through that route who did it later and got a bit of a second chance. Lemon, I mentioned Bart Lemon earlier. Visma Lisa Bike is certainly an organisation that is exploring those other sort of routes into the pro world, aren't they? But yeah, I think for the sort of prodigious early developing 17, 18 year olds, it's a great time.
Yeah, and I think add maybe Jake or Lula into that, that were looking. I heard an interview earlier in the year with Matt White actually saying that not everybody could get those. I know they've since got a really big partnership, haven't they, with Axel Merckx's development team. But they were looking at those riders who might have slipped through the net early on, have developed a bit later. So certainly suggesting young riders having a very good year, I'm not suggesting that it's the end of the game for anybody who doesn't make it there. But certainly the focus is shifting, isn't it? My final 2 points are slightly linked. I'm going to get them quickly. Jose Mourinho will be happy, I think, because I'm having quite a bit of Turkish coffee getting through this very, very quickly. In his famous rant this week. I think the tea's next. The Vuelta. I think another year where they probably felt like they maybe got one over on the Giro organisation. It seems to be stepping up every year in importance, having the better start lists, better weather. And of course, you know, that can lead us into an all other argument, which my next point's going to touch on, and in terms of climate change and things like that. The Giro had problems with that again this year and extreme weather, but the Vuelta a España, the organisation seems to do a great job, and of course it was nice for me to be with you, Daniel, on the final week this year, and we got a first hand look at that. It's a lovely race to be at. It visits some brilliant places, and you know the racing is always good, so the Vuelta keeps getting better, keeps getting more interesting. Of course, you and I are great lovers of the Giro d'Italia, but the Vuelta seems to be where it's been at in terms of the other race, apart from the Tour de France the last couple of years.
That's a bad news, potentially, for Italy, Rob, not necessarily for the Giro, but the murmurs are growing, gathering momentum, gathering volume, that Italy is no longer going to host the start of the Vuelta a España next year. Of course, that was on the cards. We've talked about it. Three stages in Piemonte, and the local press in that part of Italy, northwest Italy, has been suggesting in the last few days that might all be off.
Some late changes then, because of course Albania is now in doubt, isn't it, for the Giro d'Italia? The presentation postponed. Let's see what happens there. That brings me on to the final point. I think it's been a very good year, unfortunately, for petrol stations in Italy, Spain and France, maybe a bit of Portugal as well, as you will attest, Daniel, because you've been at each and every one of those Grand Tours on the ground. You've been doing the driving. And this is coming from me, someone who doesn't even have a driver's license. You drivers are doing far too many kilometres in the cars, buses, trucks and everything. I know there's no magic solution for this. Sorry?
I think planes is the big... planes is the by far the biggest problem. You know, transfers. By plane in races far kind of outweighs the issue of long transfers on by road, I would say.
Transfers in Grand Tours, bit of a nightmare. And again, I'm certainly not anybody who can talk in terms of setting an example. You know, I live in one country. I spend a lot of time traveling for work. My partner lives on the Spanish mainland as well. But in terms of, you know, trying to set an example and trying to do, you know, better things, which I think we all want to do if we all recognise that there's a climate crisis, cycling and the Grand Tours aren't doing a great job of it, are they? Let's be honest.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Final part, final contestant on the hockey, Richard Abrahams sort of excitedly sort of fingering his
Tutankhamun was
his ring binder. I'm slightly nervous about what we've got coming. Anyway, Richard,
the problem with writing all these notes is that I'm constantly in awe of people like yourself who make detailed notes, because in a way that you can access and refer to coherently and sort of at short notice, because I've now written too much that I'm going to have to resort to WhatsApp to get the list. Right, well, some of these are crossed over with yours, Daniel, so we don't need to dwell on them too much. But African cycling, and specifically Biniam Girmay, who we haven't mentioned. But I'm going to quote for you now. I think Billie Jean King was the source of this. You have to see it to be it. And this was something that Scarbu Girmay talked about when I interviewed him at the Tour de France. He was there with a delegation of young African riders just after one or two stage wins for Binyam Gomai. He was in the green jersey, I believe, at that point. And the point was that the significance of having Binyam winning those stages and in the green jersey in the Tour could not be overstated in terms of the impact on African cycling, young riders in Africa. And I think, what are we now, less than 12 months away from the World Championships being in Rwanda? I think it's a pretty important year for African cycling. And I think maybe one of those years that we'll look back on in the future and recognize for its significance in the way that the sport might have unfolded, let's say, over the next few decades. It's hard to tell at this point, but certainly what Binyam Gomai achieved in the Tour was, there were sort of inklings about the significance of it in terms of the future direction of the sport, you know, even then.
Richard, very briefly, I'm going to play devil's advocate again. I would suggest to you that it's actually been quite a bad year for African cycling, in the sense that, and this has been talked about quite a bit recently, in the sense that Q36.5 have shut their development team, and I forget their manager's name, but he gave an interview recently in which he talked about the sad current state of African cycling. And there has been a downward trend in representation of African riders in the World Tour.
You're like the little voice in my head that's the sort of auto-contrarian that undermines pretty much everything I ever think or say. So thanks for that, Daniel. That makes me feel...
I'll come back in with something positive for you, Richard. This year in Eurosport, we started a new YouTube channel, and I could tell you that whenever Binyam Gomai was on, the engagement we had, the interaction we had, was absolutely incredible. There is so much that's being cheered on, certainly not just by Eritreans, but by the whole of Africa as well. The comments, the, like I said, the interaction, the views, all of that stuff, the metrics went crazy whenever Binny was involved.
Should we crack on a little bit? Christian Prudhomme is on my list. I had to look this up. This was astounding me. Christian Prudhomme is about to turn 64. And I think it was actually the same day that I was talking about Binyam Gomai, the interview with Skarbu Gomai that I just referenced there, I went to interview Christian Prudhomme. And it sticks in my mind because I've interviewed Christian a number of times over the years, as sort of all of us have encountered him at one point or another. And what I realized quite quickly was that within 10 seconds of us starting and shaking hands, he had absolutely no recollection of who I was. And there's an interesting sort of series of interviews with Prudhomme where he talks about the importance of that first handshake, and that he has that length of time to remember who this person is, because his job is shaking hands with local mayors, deputies, prefects,
canapes.
Eating canapes.
Having a glass of champagne with them all. That's why I can't remember who they are, because he has to have a glass of champagne every time.
He's half cut.
But what it made me think, two things. Firstly, Christian Prudhomme is looking in very fine fettle for a 64-year-old gentleman who spends a large part of his working life eating and drinking.
He's got a bit of a limp, Richard. I don't know if you noticed this, Chris. I don't know if he's just injured this. I don't know if he's just injured this year. But
okay, anyway. I'll scratch that off my list then.
No, otherwise he looks good. Otherwise he looks good. I'm just saying this out of
limping
concern.
Limping Christian Prudhomme.
Yeah, wasn't
poor old Chris. Anyway, the broader point was that it wasn't a classic tour for the ages, but it was a pretty good one, wasn't it? And there was a lot of chat at the start of the year about One Cycling and this investment in the sport and a shake-up and this and that. And I find myself again, perhaps because the Tour de France presentation is relatively fresh in the memory, but the Tour de France still exerts its position as the sun at the center of the solar system of the sport. And that there doesn't seem to be any signs of that changing, I think. That the gravity that exerts was just impressed upon me even more so this year. So a good year for Christian Prudhomme. And you're okay, Christian. It's okay that you didn't remember who I was. Savoul Bas, the pub quiz question of the future. What town did Mark Cavendish win his 35th stage in? at just outside Saint-Vulbas. Something like 1,500 people live in Saint-Vulbas. It's got an enormous nuclear power station. It's the centre for the International Federation of Boule, I believe. Indoor
it's
Boule.
Also, and it's huge, also... Rich, sorry, go on.
Well, a huge logistics hub as well. Something just stuck in my mind about how they must have been absolutely delighted that history was written on a sort of fairly nondescript wide main road on the edge of their town. And I think pretty much all you could hope for as the mayor of Saint-Vulbas is its place in tour history. What were you going to say, Daniel, about that?
No, it's also home. I noticed this on the day itself when we were waiting outside the Astana bus, which Julie sort of erupted, not literally, when Cavendish came over the line and broke the record, that it's the home of a huge MAPE plant. MAPE, of course, sponsored the sort of most successful team in cycling at the start of the 21st century. They got a couple of huge plants in France, one's in Toulouse. However, I just had to verify this online before we recorded today that it was that my eyes hadn't been deceiving me. And I was kind of intrigued as to why the huge MAPE plant in Saint-Vulbas had a rating of 3.3 stars out of 5 on Google reviews, and it had quite a lot of reviews, and I just wondered what on earth people were reviewing.
Was this before or after you zoomed in on the Lay's Bugles deep dive?
No, this is after. Okay. This is after. However, what I found out is that these huge factory, I guess this is a bit of a thing, heavy goods vehicle drivers, HGV drivers, they go on to Google review to talk about how easy it is or isn't to load up their cargo in these places. And the first review I saw of the MAPE plant, Saint-Vulbas, went as follows. Hello, a shameful and very dishonest company. I advise all companies and individuals not to call on the service of MAPE Control of Saint-Vulbas. You will lose a fortune and bite your fingers. And what's worse, MAPE insults and sends shit. Its customers, sincerely, it's the worst company in France, probably beyond. Don't even talk about it. They are vomit. 0 stars. Even less than that, if it would be possible. What's more, I deliver in short and flip-flop and forced to put on safety shoes, which I refuse to do because safety shoes in front of an officer counter, there is zero risk.
I think in the spirit of journalistic integrity, Daniel, that we have trumpeted hitherto in this episode, invite... I feel MAPE deserve a reply to this.
Well, having worked for MAPE before, as regular listeners of the podcast will know, I will take it upon myself to act as ambassador, spokesperson, press secretary for MAPE Saint-Vulbas. And so it deserves a solid 5 stars. Disregard everything that gentleman said. It's a cracking company and a cracking place to load up your HGV. Mm.
Host Daniel Free, but only on the podcast for balance.
Yes.
In the pocket of who are we adding now into the Ineos PR department? Lay's crisps and MAPE loading services.
Shimano, Carrefour,
Shimano. Well, talking of Shimano, I'm going to segue away. It's been a good year for manufacturers of cranks that are 165 millimeters long. The number of times I heard that referred to during Tadej Pogacar, there he is again, his various exploits. But curiously, I don't think that will have done any harm for, well, probably Shimano, but whoever else makes them. I've just fitted them to a winter bike of mine under advice of an independent professional bike fitter. So I'm quite interested to see the impact that that has on my riding, whether I'm...
You could be winning.
I'm barely riding 80 kilometers at the moment, so I'm not sure I'm going to be
young Richard Abraham
capable of doing it.
My tip for tour glory in 2025.
Yeah. Anyway, on the list next, Remco Evenepoel. I mean, we haven't really mentioned Remco's year, have we? But 2 Olympic gold medals, a rainbow jersey, and I think most significantly for me, there was always that question about Remco and the Tour de France, a sort of, is he capable of shouldering the pressure, the expectations, delivering on the biggest stage? And I think the answer's got to be yes, or at least for this year. Not on the same level as Pogacar, obviously, but a pretty impressive performance from Remco Evenepoel. Chaps, I don't know what you thought about his year, any sort of interactions you had with him, but I thought it was very impressive. I'm not sure I saw much in that tour to suspect that he's going to be giving Vingegaard, you know, a healthy Vingegaard and Pogacar a run for their money in the future. I don't know. But certainly, I'd say he's the world's best time trialist at the moment.
With Remco, I'm with you. I was really impressed. I have to admit, I didn't know what to expect in the Tour de France. I wondered, A, where he'd finish, B, how he'd go. But I think massively matured in terms of temperament and his interaction. I know he's always been professional with his dealings with the media and everything because of, you know, much talked about former life as a young footballer. And I think with Daniel in a minute, we'll probably get on to the interactions he did give throughout the year. But I thought observing from afar, from the commentary box, really, really impressed. And performances, I mean, you know, if Pogacar hadn't done what he'd done, then we'd be talking about Evenepoel's achievements a lot more. And I know that Daniel, you saw him on the ground up close and personal and will have seen that maturity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, charming, quotable, charismatic, polished and pretty mature in interviews as well. So, you know, thumbs up for
and
me.
I think we should say as well, that coming from the guy who probably had much more home media pressure on him than the other two that we've spoken about there in terms of you know, Pogacar and Vingegaard, Evenepoel coming from where he comes from, it's a different story, isn't it? And it's difficult to convey, actually, the intensity and the fervour of Belgian media coverage of cycling unless you've actually been in amongst it in that scrum.
Moving on in a slightly less serious vein, Mini Mullets. I think Mini Mullets had their peak just before Paris-Roubaix when... Specifically, I'm going to attach this Mini Mullet to Laurence Pithy because he impressed me as a young rider of the year, I think, on his way to Red Bull, yep, if I'm not mistaken, next season. And Stefan Kung, Olivier Legac, Valentin Madouas, who actually also had a pretty good year, come to think of it, Madouas. But there was a really nice little video in the classics of Pithy giving them all haircuts, this sort of mini mullet, not quite a full-blown, you know, long sort of whatever you'd call it.
Business at the front, only a small party. Only a mullet. Small party at the back. Only a small gathering.
And Van der Poel had one at the start of the year as well, which then disappeared for Flanders and Roubaix, which was slightly disappointing from my perspective. But not, I didn't dive quite as deeply into it as you, Daniel, seem to have done with crisps and whatnot. But obviously the Antipodean influence. But it does seem like that I've seen citations of a Catalan influence on the mullet as well, popular in Catalonia apparently.
Yeah, you
but
see
Rob's making a face.
Rob, in Catalonia and in the Basque Country, you see quite a lot of
Basque Country.
These Aguirres have sported that kind of look for quite a long time. Yeah.
Basque Country.
Well, Jon has. Yeah.
It's been a good year for Colnago, who became Tour de France bike sponsors a few years ago, but I was reading they've seen their sales triple since 2020, and bucking the trend, I think, in terms of the bike industry. The overall narrative for the bike industry across the board has been one of doom and gloom, over-ordering, sitting on far too much inventory, having to slash prices, businesses going bust. And I think it's quite a good news story that an Italian heritage brand, or what was, that really had a long history in the sport, but perhaps wasn't as perceived to be on the cutting edge as much as a company like Specialized or Giant, one of those big manufacturers, has actually managed to cement itself as sort of one of the best performing companies and most desirable bikes in the sport. I mean, we're talking bigger picture here, but I think that's quite a good news story. And I think if I were at Colnago, I'd at the end of season do somewhere nice in Italy. Where are they based, Colnago?
Do you know what I heard the other day? Do you know what I heard recently? That Ernesto Colnago, I'm not sure he does it, he still does it, but he's over 90 now and still healthy, by all accounts. He used to call Tadej Pogacar every day and Pogacar would answer every day.
Seriously? Well, just asked him what he's had in his cornflakes and stuff like that, or what he was watching on Netflix.
I don't really know. I can't reveal too much about the actual nature of the conversations, what was spoken about. I think they were talking about bikes. I was quite charmed by the idea of Pogacar, you know, not sort of dutifully or not kind of cool screening.
Do you reckon he had like a special ringtone for him and everything?
Taking the call. Maybe had his little picture on there and answering it. Yeah. And giving him an audience.
Yeah. Well, there's another Merckx comparison. Colnago and Merckx had their very close relationship, didn't they, back in the day? 70s?
Yes. Yeah.
So there we go. And that, well, Richard, that pretty much
does
wraps
that conclude
it up.
The list?
That concludes my list.
Well, it feels like we should declare a winner at this point, but I don't think we're going to do that. And as the host and the man who wields the most power here, would obviously declare myself the victor. We won't do that today. This is a democracy. This remains a democracy in spite of, anyway, chaps, next week we will get to the things, the people, the teams who didn't have such a good year. Next week, it will be time to talk about the annus horribilis. Who had one? Who had a shocker in 2024? I would ask you to go away and prepare your list for that as well. And thank you in the meantime for your very valuable and insightful and in some cases amusing contributions today. So, chaps, until then, thank you and goodbye.
Good night. Ciao.
Good night. Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.